He rented a small garage. From there, he and a few friends sold about $2,000 worth of services daily. It is estimated that Kinko's has annual sales in excess of $600 million. But what if Mr. Orfila's parents had socialized their son in an environment similar to Ms. BPF's? Would he be as productive today? It's very unlikely. Mr. Orfila has what all successful business owners possess, considerable courage. Taking financial risk is evidence of courage. But what risk has Ms. BPF ever taken? Very little. Webster's defines courage as mental or moral strength to resist opposition, danger, or hardship. It implies firmness of mind and will in the face of danger or extreme difficulty. Courage can be developed, but it cannot be nurtured in an environment that eliminates all risks, all difficulty, all dangers. That is precisely why Ms. BPF lacks the courage to leave home, expand her business, and wean herself from heavy doses of economic inpatient care. It takes considerable courage to work in an environment in which one is compensated according to one's performance. Most affluent people have courage. What evidence supports this statement? Most affluent people in America are either business owners or employees who are paid on an incentive basis. Remember, whether their parents were wealthy or not, most of the affluent in America acquired their wealth on their own. They had the courage to undertake entrepreneurial and other business opportunities that were associated with considerable risk. One of the greatest entrepreneurs and extraordinary sales professionals of all time, Ray Kroc, looked for courage in selecting potential McDonald's franchise owners and executives. Kroc actually welcomed cold-calling sales professionals. He told his secretary to send all of them in. Why? Because it's not easy finding people who have the courage to be evaluated strictly on their own performance. He sold his first franchise outside California for $950 to Sanford and Betty Agate. See John Love's book, McDonald's, Behind the Arches. Kroc first encountered Betty Agate while she was making cold calls on people in Chicago's financial district. Kroc's secretary asked, "What the hell is a Jew doing selling Catholic Bibles?" "Making a living," was her reply. Kroc reasoned that anyone courageous enough to do what Betty Agate was doing would be a prime prospect for purchasing one of his franchises. How many cold calls has Ms. BPF made in her life? Zero. Most of the people who buy from her are friends or business associates of her parents and relatives. Calls to these people are warm calls. Parents often ask us how to instill courage in their children. We suggest that children be exposed to the sales profession. Encourage your children to run for class office in their elementary or high school. They will have to sell themselves to the student body. Even selling Girl Scout cookies can have a positive impact. Retail sales jobs provide another way for children to be evaluated by very objective third parties. A woman of great courage. Facts to William D. Danko, Ph.D., Albany, New York. From Thomas J. Stanley, Ph.D., Atlanta, Georgia. Regarding A Woman of Great Courage. Date, Labor Day, A.M. Guess where your colleague was at 5:30 this morning? I was boarding an early bird flight. Although the plane had room for more than 100 passengers, only about 20 people were on board. Soon after I sat down, we were told there was a fog over the destination and that there would be another famous short delay. As I stood up, the woman, I'll call her Laura, sitting in front of me, also stood up. I mentioned to her that I was displeased about having to get up so early to make this flight. She responded that she had been flying all night and still had one more leg in her flight. I asked Laura why she was traveling at night. She replied that it was a lot more economical to do so. What I found out shortly thereafter was that this woman did not have to fly via a highly discounted ticket. She, in fact, was affluent, but she was also very frugal. What was the purpose of Laura's travel? She was en route to a conference of real estate executives, where she was to receive the Real Estate Executive of the Year Award. I then asked her how she first became involved in the real estate profession. Laura replied, "Out of necessity." Laura told me that one morning she found a note from her husband on the kitchen table. Allow me to quote the contents. "Dear Laura, I'm in love with my secretary. My attorney will fill you in on the details. Wish you and the children good luck. How did Laura, a housewife with three small children, respond to this information? She was determined not to return to her old job as a high school teacher. Nor would she ever ask her well-to-do parents for economic support. She had grown up in an environment that nurtured independence and discipline. She wondered what she could do with undergraduate and master's degrees in English literature. She discovered that people with her educational background were in great supply and reasoned that her income from her teaching, editing, and writing jobs were not likely to be enough to support her family's current lifestyle. Thereupon, Laura discussed various employment opportunities with several enlightened business owners in the community. After these discussions, she decided to try the field of real estate sales. During her first 4 months, she earned more selling real estate than she did in her best year teaching English. I know you would want to ask Laura the factors she feels contributed to her success. She told me this. It's amazing what you can do when you set your mind to it. You'll be surprised how many sales calls you can make when you have no alternative except to succeed. As a young woman, Laura had developed an excellent foundation for her sales career. While attending school, she had convinced dozens of employers to hire her for summer jobs. She also had a variety of part-time jobs while attending high school and college. Laura was so good at finding jobs that she helped many of her friends find employment. No doubt she could have had much success in starting an executive recruiting firm. Laura was also the campaign manager for several of her friends who won student government offices in both high school and college. It's ironic that Laura's misfortune in marrying a man who lacked integrity eventually translated into a much better life for her and her children. Because of his transgressions, Laura was able to fully utilize all her talents. The irony is that she always had more potential than her husband to excel in the business world. It's a proven fact today. She is much better off than her former husband. Her success is also a function of her high level of integrity, something that was lacking in her former husband. After several banner years as a sales professional, Laura founded a highly successful real estate company. In spite of her dramatic financial success, she still flies on the red eyes and early birds. You would never think this woman had so much courage and stamina just by looking at her. I would estimate that she is barely 5 feet tall and weighs no more than 95 pounds. However, as we have often agreed, appearances are much less important than the courage, discipline, and resolve of people who are economically productive. Affirmative action, family style. Their adult children are economically self-sufficient. Most affluent parents who have adult children want to reduce the size of their estate before they pass away. Certainly this decision makes sense, given that the alternative is to leave their children with a significant estate tax liability. The decision to share their wealth with their children is easy. The difficult decision is how to divide the capital. Affluent parents who have younger children usually believe that the distribution of their wealth will never be a problem. They assume their assets will be distributed equally. Those parents with four children, for example, typically state that their wealth will be distributed equally among their children, 25% to each. This simple distribution formula becomes more complex as the children mature. Parents of adult children are likely to find that some of their children have a greater need for substantial financial gifts than others. Who should get more? Who should get less? These are questions everyone must answer. Nonetheless, affluent parents are likely to benefit from several important research findings. Parents with non-working adult daughters and temporarily unemployed adult sons have a high propensity to provide these children with heavy doses of economic outpatient care, EOC. These children are also likely to receive a disproportionately large portion of their parents' estates. The more economically successful offspring are likely to receive smaller levels of EOC and inheritance. Many of the most highly productive sons and daughters receive no wealth transfers whatsoever. Yet, as we have discussed, that's one reason they're wealthy. Housewives, A or B? Much of the variation in gift-giving among different children can be explained by occupation, or socioeconomic status, and gender. We have found that housewives have the highest propensity of all major occupational groups to receive inheritances as well as periodic financial gifts from their parents. In fact, housewives are 3 times more likely to receive substantial inheritances from their parents than are adult children of the affluent on average. In essence, housewives rank first in both the size of their inheritances and the incidence of inheriting wealth from their parents. They are also most likely to receive significant financial gifts on an annual basis. We have identified 2 distinct types of housewife daughters of the affluent. We'll call them type A and type B. Both benefit to different degrees from their parents' beliefs that non-working women must have money of their own, that the economic deck is stacked against women, and that sons-in-law can never be fully trusted to provide support for their wives and children. The type A housewife differs significantly from her type B counterpart. Type A's tend to marry high-income-producing, successful men. They tend to take leadership roles in caring for their elderly, sometimes disabled, parents. The gifts and inheritance they tend to receive are, in part, compensation for these efforts, efforts their working brothers and sisters are more likely to shy away from. Type A housewives are well-educated and tend to be the executrixes or co-executors of their parents' estates. They are likely to be leaders and volunteers in various local, educational, and charitable organizations. Type A housewives are often viewed by their parents as peers and confidants rather than understudies. They are seen as intelligent, strong leaders and advisors, and are frequently consulted about important family matters, such as estate and retirement planning, the sale of a family business, and the choice of professional service providers. Type A's are also conversant with estate tax laws. They are likely to encourage their parents to reduce the size of their estate and thus minimize the estate tax by providing gifts to their children. Type A housewives receive substantial cash gifts throughout the early and middle stages of their lives, often from the time they are married. Later, gifts are associated with the purchase of a home and in some situations the purchase of investment real estate. The presence of a type A housewife is of great benefit to affluent parents, as well as to their other adult children, since type A's often carry the enormous burden of providing for the emotional and medical needs of their elderly parents. Type B housewives, in contrast, are viewed as adult children who need economic outpatient care and even emotional support. They tend to be dependent on others and are unlikely to be leaders in any capacity. Type B's tend to marry men who are not likely to produce high incomes. They tend to be less well-educated than the women in the type A category. The parents of type B housewives often subsidize their daughter's household income in order to help their daughter's family maintain a minimum middle-class lifestyle. Type B housewives tend to live in close proximity to their parents. They often accompany their mothers on shopping trips. It's not unusual for middle-aged type B housewives to receive clothing allowances from their affluent mothers and fathers. Parents also care for their type B daughters via provisions in wills and estate plans. They are provided with cash gifts and inheritance because their parents believe they really need the money. In essence, type B's are cared for by their parents instead of the other way around. The parents of type B housewives tend to hold back from distributing substantial cash gifts to their daughters out of fear that their daughters and their husbands may be poor money managers. Thus, cash gifts for type B housewives tend to be on a need basis, such as when type B's husband is between jobs or when there is a birth in the family. Gifts are often precipitated by crises and may range from direct cash payments to clothing and tuition reimbursement. Nonetheless, type B's receive the bulk of their parents' wealth in the form of inheritance. Often their parents' wills provide specific instructions regarding the distribution schedule and educational funds for their daughter's children. Often the family of the type B housewife never becomes financially independent. It is not unusual for the type B housewife in her mid-50s to still be receiving cash subsidies from her parents. Nor is it unusual for the husband of a type B housewife to work for her parents' business. In some cases, the level of compensation is substantially higher than the objective labor market would indicate. In other words, the son-in-law in these situations is earning more as an employee of his in-law's business than he would working for an objective third party. Even sons-in-law who are employed outside the family business often moonlight for the family, working part-time at premium wages for the family business, or doing chores or odd jobs for their in-laws. Daughters who are not housewives but are employed in full-time positions are less likely to receive cash gifts and inheritance than their non-working sisters. But even daughters who are employed in high-status occupations are more likely to receive cash gifts and inheritance than their economically successful brothers. Why? As stated previously, affluent parents feel rather strongly that women, even working women, must have money of their own. They also contend that their sons-in-law can never be fully trusted to remain loyal to support and protect their daughters. Actually, the affluent are rather perceptive in this regard. Our data indicate that more than 4 in 10 of their daughters who marry will be divorced at least once. Affirmative action for women. Affluent parents understand that the income-generating opportunities facing men and women in this country are very different. These parents tend to have their own form of economic affirmative action. Consider the following facts. Women account for 46% of the workers in this country, but represent fewer than 20% of the individuals who earn $100,000 or more annually. In 1980, fewer than 40,000 women had annual incomes of $100,000 or more. In 1995, approximately 400,000 women were in this income category. This translates into a tenfold increase. By the year 2000, more than 600,000 women will have incomes in the six-figure and higher category. But again, as in 1995, there will still be 5 men for every woman in this income category. Women have made significant progress in regard to the proportion who graduate from professional schools. In 1970, for example, only 8.4% of medical school graduates were women. In 1995, nearly 40% were women. In 1970, women accounted for about 6% of all law school graduates. In 1995, they made up nearly 45%. A high-status occupational title does not automatically translate into a high income, however. A recent census headline stated, "Earnings gaps in 1995 still apparent even for professional degree holders." In this regard, women employed in professional occupations in 1995 earned only 49.2% of what men in professional occupations earned. How do the salaries of men and women in high-income producing occupations compare? In 20 out of 20 of the highest income producing occupations, women on average earn significantly less than their male counterparts. For example, female physicians earn only 52% of what male physicians earn. Female dentists earn 57.4% of what male dentists earn. Female podiatrists earn 55% of what male podiatrists earn. And female lawyers earn 57.5% of what male lawyers earn. In 1980, approximately 45% of the women in the six-figure and higher income category did not work. Conversely, 55% earned $100,000 or more via employment. These percentages have not changed appreciably since 1980, nor are they likely to change through the year 2005. In sharp contrast, nearly 80% of the men in this country who earn $100,000 or more are employed. Most of the other 20% are over 60 years of age and retired. The vast majority of non-working women who have annual incomes of $100,000 or more inherited their wealth and or received substantial financial gifts from their parents, grandparents, and or spouses. Their income is typically generated from interest, dividends, capital gains, net rental income, and such. Women own nearly one-third of the small businesses in America. However, approximately two-thirds of these businesses have annual revenues of under $50,000. Working women are more than 4 times more likely to leave the workplace than are working men. The objective data make it quite clear. In America, the odds are against women earning high incomes. Some of this variation in income can certainly be explained by biases in the economic marketplace. But biases alone do not fully explain the fact that there are 5 men for every 1 woman in the top 1% of the earned income distribution. Could it be that the tendency for affluent parents to subsidize their daughters is helping to perpetuate this inequality? Daughters of wealthy couples tend not to have careers of their own. Why? In the past 20 years, the affluent population has typically been composed of one type of household. More than 80% have been married couples with children in which the wife did not work full-time. What message did this send to the daughters of such couples? Simply stated, mother did not work, and the marriage survived, so perhaps I should not work. It is difficult to argue with such logic. The traditional affluent family system does, in fact, function quite well. Affluent couples have a divorce rate that is less than half the norm. The father works, the mother mothers and does everything else for her family system is very often copied by the female products of such marriages. Many affluent parents actually encourage their daughters not to work, not to have their own careers, and not to be economically and psychologically independent. Affluent parents instill this dependence characteristic in their daughters over time with subtle cues. Thus, many affluent parents communicate messages such as the following to their daughters. Don't worry. If you don't want to have a career of your own, you don't have to worry about money. We will help you out financially. If you do have a career, if you do become a big success and become independent, you will not be receiving any major financial gifts or inheritance from us. The weak and the strong. Anne and Beth, housewives and daughters. Anne is 35 years of age. She is the younger daughter of a couple we'll call Robert and Ruth Jones. Her parents are millionaires. Mr. Jones owns and operates several businesses in the distribution industry. Mrs. Jones is a traditional housewife. She never completed college and has never been employed outside the home. She is, however, active in several noble causes in her community. When her children were young, she served on the PTA. Her daughter Anne is very candid about her relationship with her parents. "It would be so easy," she said, "to take money from my parents. For the house, for private school tuition, but it always comes with strings. My sister Beth, age 37, learned that. She does not lead her own life. She has learned that the dole comes with a price. Do it mother's way." Anne understood the components of the parental control equation early on. When she was first married, she and her husband sought employment out of town. She insulated herself from her parents' influence by putting more than 1,000 miles between herself and them. Anne gave up her own career after her second child was born. But unlike her sister Beth, Anne never accepted economic outpatient care from her parents. Anne became sensitive to the real cost of being on the dole by observing her sister's experience. According to Anne, Beth and her family live in subsidized housing. Mr. and Mrs. Jones made a sizable down payment on Beth's home. They also doled out thousands of dollars to Beth each year for housing and other expenses. She receives $20,000 in cash from her parents every Christmas. Beth lives less than 2 miles from her parents. One of the proven ways that domineering parents control their adult children is by living close to them. Anne reports that there is some confusion about home ownership between Beth and her parents. It seems that mother is always at Beth's, invited or not. And mother was more involved with the choice of Beth's home than Beth was. Beth married and became a mother before completing college. She and her husband lived with her parents for 3 years after they were married. This gave her husband an opportunity to complete college. Neither worked even part-time during this period. Beth's husband completed college and accepted an administrative position with a regional corporation, but after less than 2 years, his position was eliminated. He then accepted a position as vice president of administration in his father-in-law's business. According to Anne, the vice president of administration was a newly titled position. The former title was office manager. But, as Anne explained, the job pays very well, and you should get a load of the splendid fringe benefit package. It is difficult under such conditions for Beth and her husband to develop much self-confidence. Anne's parents, especially her father, do not show respect for Beth's husband. According to Anne, they always felt he was socially, economically, and intellectually Beth's inferior. They demonstrate much more respect for Anne's husband, who graduated with honors from a prestigious college and earned a master's degree with distinction at the age of 24. Robert and Ruth constantly tell their friends and relations of the great accomplishments of our Anne's husband. Robert and Ruth rolled out the red carpet for Anne's future husband the first time he paid them a visit. they were very impressed with his academic credentials. Anne reported that during this brief stay, Beth's husband, then a boarder with his in-laws, acted much like a waiter. Father-in-law Robert would direct his son-in-law to mix and serve drinks and snacks, for example. After several cocktails one evening, Robert referred to his son-in-law as a bozo. Anne and her beau were shocked. This treatment left a lasting impression on the couple. Anne pledged that she and her husband would never become bozos in her parents' eyes. To date, she has kept her pledge. This is the case even though Anne's parents pressure her unrelentingly to accept economic outpatient care. In contrast, Robert and Ruth regularly ask Beth's husband to do chores for them. They treat him more like a handyman and chauffeur than the man who married their older daughter. Why does Beth's husband tolerate this situation? Because he has been conditioned to do so. He and Beth have a high-consumption lifestyle congruent with that of his in-laws. Yet their ability to sustain such a lifestyle is a function of their being controlled. Robert and Ruth have communicated a central message to Beth, not so much in words as in deeds. Beth, you and your husband are not capable of generating enough income on your own to maintain your ascribed station in life. You are economically handicapped. You and your husband need our special brand of economic outpatient care. Are Robert and Ruth correct that Beth and her husband would be unable to achieve in life without assistance? An objective third party would contend that they are. But what would the same objective third party say if he had examined this situation from its origin? He might have concluded that Robert and Ruth made a special effort to prove their hypothesis. After even just a few years of receiving aggressive and overbearing economic outpatient care, Beth and her husband have lost much of their ambition, economic self-confidence, and independence. No one will ever know if this couple could have functioned productively on its own. Beth and her husband were never given this opportunity. The role of enlightened parents is to strengthen the weak. Robert and Ruth did just the opposite. They weakened the weak and continue to do so today. Not surprisingly, they never appreciated their role in causing much of the dependency Beth and her husband experience today. Today, Anne has some resentment, even bitterness, towards her parents. She holds them responsible for creating the economic and emotional dependency that her sister and brother-in-law must deal with every day. Anne has learned much from Beth and her husband's experiences. Anne is especially sensitive about her parents' role in usurping control of her sister's children. In them, the mistakes of the past are likely to be repeated. Anne can only wish that her parents had followed some simple rules about raising children to be independent. They can't now, but Anne can. It's not too late for her. Anne will never allow her parents to control any portion of her life or the lives of her husband and children. Cinderella Sarah. Sarah is an executive in her late 50s. Her parents were affluent. Her father started his own business when she was quite young. When we interviewed her, Sarah was extremely candid about her relationship with her papa and sister. Sarah's father was a very strong-willed individual. His views about the role of women in our society were at odds with Sarah's. He felt that women should be educated in the fine arts and then marry, have children, and never work outside the home. Women, according to Papa's dictates, were not to have careers of their own. They were to be supportive, even subservient, to their husbands. As a teenager, Sarah enjoyed debating Papa on numerous topics, including the role of liberated women in our culture. Often these debates turned into arguments, centered on how Sarah would spend the rest of her life. Papa frequently threatened his defiant daughter with the loss of financial support for her college education, dowry, and so forth. In spite of these threats, Sarah left home when she was a young woman. Her papa made good on his promise and withheld all financial support. Yet Sarah never lost her determination to become financially and emotionally independent from her parents. After leaving home, she became a proofreader for a large publishing company. During her career in the publishing industry, she rose to a very senior position. Eventually, she married, but only after her own career was well established. Sarah was distinctly different from her sister Alice. Unlike Sarah, Alice, a type B housewife, filled the role that Papa had assigned her. She was clearly Papa's girl. Papa's girl married a local gentleman, a fellow from a lower social stratum who had a high propensity to spend but little propensity to earn an income. In light of this fact, Papa placed Alice, her low-income-producing husband, and their three children on his own special brand of financial outpatient care. Papa would never allow his favorite daughter to live in a home or neighborhood that was incongruent with his own upper-middle-class image. He heavily subsidized the purchase of a home and accessories for Alice and her family. Significant cash gifts and gifts of securities were bestowed upon Papa's girl annually. Given these liberal subsidies, one might predict that Papa's girl would have accumulated a considerable amount of wealth. In fact, she and her husband accumulated very little money during all the years they were on outpatient care. Their budgeting system was quite simple. Spend more than you earn, and more than you receive in cash gifts. The balance will be absorbed by Papa. All during this time, Sarah, like many executives, received no outpatient care from Papa. Instead, she was punished for her audacity in violating the strict doctrines Papa had set for her. When Papa passed away, Alice received no more annual outpatient care, although his favorite daughter did receive the bulk of what was left of his wealth. Sarah received a much smaller amount. She was surprised that she received any part of her father's estate, especially since he had told her shortly before his death that she would receive a lot less than sister. In his mind, his liberated and very independent daughter had much less need for an inheritance than did her sister, a type B housewife. It did not take many years for Alice, the favorite daughter, and her husband to spend nearly all of Papa's money. Shortly thereafter, Alice passed away. How did her children survive? Their own father did not have enough income to maintain their upper-middle-class lifestyle. Who provided for them? Who paid for their college educations? None other than their aunt, the recipient of no outpatient care, the semi-disinherited Cinderella Sarah. During all the years her father had supported her sister, Sarah had never hardened or demonstrated any animosity toward Alice. Sarah never forgot to send a little gift to Alice on her birthdays. She never forgot to send Christmas and birthday presents to Alice's children. Sarah is, in fact, a very successful, independent, compassionate woman. Today, Sarah is a self-made millionaire. She is in charge of her own family's finances and is in the process of setting up trust funds for her sister's children and future grandchildren. Sarah feels this is important. Regarding Alice's daughters, she told us, they know nothing about money. How could they? Their role models were their parents, typical UAWs. Sarah is a prodigious accumulator of wealth. Even today, she is frugal and very well disciplined as a consumer. Her net worth is many times higher than her annual salary as an executive. Sarah told us, "People would be astonished to know how much money I have accumulated. I know how to hold on to it." Like many wealthy people, Sarah is in the process of subsidizing the incomes of others, the products of under-accumulating, over-consuming parents. People often ask us how offspring of the same parents can differ so much when it comes to accumulating wealth. How could Sarah and her sister be so different? We're convinced that some differences exist at birth. Much of the difference, however, can be explained by variations in how parents relate to each of their children. Papa encouraged Sarah to become a prodigious accumulator while fostering the opposite trait in her sister. In essence, he strengthened the strong daughter while weakening the weaker one. When Sarah left home, she burned her bridges. She received no outpatient subsidies. She had no choice but to learn how to fish for herself, and she taught herself very well. At the same time, her sister became progressively more dependent on Papa for his money. Sarah had compassion for her parents, particularly Papa. He sacrificed much and worked extremely hard to become an affluent business owner. Papa was determined that his children would not have to work so hard and have to face the risk of doing on their own. But the willingness and ability to work hard, take risks, and sacrifice were the qualities that made him a successful and affluent business owner. Somehow, like many of his peers, he forgot how he became wealthy. Many parents say there is nothing wrong with providing outpatient care. This is true, perhaps, if the recipients are already well-disciplined and have demonstrated that they are able to generate a decent living without other people's money. For example, what effect would accepting some outpatient care have had on Sarah once she had taught herself how to succeed, then excel at her chosen field? The answer is probably very little. She was mature enough, strong enough to deal with money, hers or anyone else's. The real tragedy is the helplessness of those who come to depend on outpatient care. Without Aunt Sarah's kindness, her nieces would likely be terrified of the future. Luckily for them, Sarah is helping. Wiser than Papa, she will provide trusts for these young women. Such financial support will benefit them much more in the long run than would substantial gifts of cash. Some of the funds in the trusts Aunt Sarah is setting up for her nieces are earmarked for education. The rest will not be distributed until these young women demonstrate considerable maturity. Sarah defines maturity as the proven ability to earn a good living. It is not her intention to create another generation of weak sisters. Still, Sarah is very realistic about her sister's children. She realizes it is very difficult for teenagers to reorient themselves. It is unclear if her teenage nieces will one day become strong, independent women like their Aunt Sarah. It may be too late. They may have already been too heavily socialized in the consumption and dependent lifestyle they experienced at home. Fortunately, Sarah is a strong role model. She is confident she can have a positive impact on the behaviors and personalities of her nieces. Moreover, the compassion and love Sarah gives her nieces cannot be measured in dollars. What did Sarah really want from her own papa? Much more than money, she wanted his love and recognition of her splendid achievements. Today, Sarah has few regrets. She never dwells on the past except when speaking of her father. Although Sarah still feels she was never recognized by her father, she will tell you that she capitalized on this need. Much of Sarah's ambition and drive stem from the need to have her achievements recognized by others. So it is with many Cinderellas who turn some adversity in their early lives into lifetimes of achievement. The Unemployed Adult Child. Like Type B housewives, unemployed adult children are significantly more likely to receive annual cash gifts from their parents than are their working siblings. In fact, our research findings regarding the incidence as well as the actual dollar amounts of gifts received are likely understated, since about 1 in 4 male children, 25 to 35 years of age, resides with his affluent parents, and some respondents did not perceive this living situation as gift-giving or receiving. Male adult children, by the way, are more than twice as likely to live at home than female adult children. Often the unemployed have a history of being in and out of work. Others are so-called professional students. Typically, their parents view these children as needing the money more than their brothers and sisters do, now and in the future. Thus, the unemployed are more than twice as likely as their working brothers and sisters to receive inheritances. Often the adult child in this category has close emotional as well as economic ties to his parent. He is significantly more likely to live in close proximity to his parents, down the street perhaps, or even in the same home. It is not unusual, especially among unemployed adult male children, for the child to act as the household handyman, assistant, or errand boy. The unemployed adult often receives his first cash gift when he shows signs of being unable to maintain or uninterested in maintaining full-time employment. Some young adults who receive substantial cash gifts move back home upon graduation from college or graduate school. Others receive substantial cash gifts for housing, food, clothing, tuition, and transportation. The parents often pay for medical care and health insurance as well. Many of these cash gifts come from overfunded college tuition savings plans. When the adult children decide not to continue their educations, there often is a substantial amount of money that is legally theirs. This money is often used to help them maintain a comfortable lifestyle. Unemployment during the early stages of adulthood is related to unemployment at later stages in life. Many unemployed middle-aged sons and daughters receive direct cash subsidies, often annually. Further, the incidence of unemployment is associated with larger and more frequent gifts. These adult children are also more likely than their brothers and sisters who are employed to receive inheritances in the form of personal real estate. Before and after you're gone. For one of our focus group interviews, we asked a recruiter to supply us with 8 to 10 millionaires for the 3-hour session. All were supposed to be PAWs and to have a minimum of $3 million in net worth. We also instructed our recruiter that the millionaires had to be 65 years or older. Each was to receive $200 for participating. 2 days before the interview, 9 millionaires had been recruited. But on the morning of the interview, our recruiter telephoned to tell us that one of them would not be able to participate. The recruiter said that she would likely be able to find a substitute. Just an hour before the interview, the recruiter telephoned us again to say she had found a 62-year-old recruit. He was a business owner with a high income, but he did not fit the strict definition of a PAW. Nevertheless, we agreed to include him. The decision proved fortuitous. The substitute respondent, Mr. Andrews, was not told beforehand that the other respondents were affluent. Perhaps that was why he took the lead in bragging about how he was very well off financially. In reality, Mr. Andrews had a high income but a relatively small net worth. He was a classic UAW who looked and acted the part. He wore gold bracelets on each wrist and had an expensive-looking diamond-encrusted watch and several rings. When Mr. Andrews began telling the group his story, he exuded confidence. But after 3 hours of talking with 8 wiser men, his demeanor changed. His confidence seemed to deteriorate as the interview progressed. We believe Mr. Andrews learned some important lessons that day about financial planning and the intergenerational distribution of wealth. Mr. Andrews told us that he was already well off and had already achieved his financial goals. But when questioned, he could not articulate his goals. A major part of his plan was to earn a high income. He always assumed that most of the other parts of his financial plan would take care of themselves. We have interviewed many UAWs like Mr. Andrews. No matter how we ask them about their financial goals, their responses are predictable. Do you know how many celebrities live in my neighborhood? I make a lot of money. I live 2 houses away from a rock star. My daughter married a guy who earns a tremendous income. What do UAWs such as Mr. Andrews tend to emphasize in telling us about themselves? Their income, consumption habits, and status artifacts. PAWs speak of their achievements, such as their scholarship and how they've built their businesses. You will notice that Mr. Andrews, the UAW, has a much different financial orientation than the 8 PAWs who participated in our focus group interview. Several of the more senior respondents reflected on their experiences in unusually great detail. We don't think this information would have flowed so easily if it had not been for the initial comments made by Mr. Andrews. His views, so different from the others, prompted an exchange that resulted in the PAWs providing valuable advice on such issues as gift-giving, the role and selection of executors, conflicts among heirs, trusts, and the pros and cons of controlling children and grandchildren from the grave. We began our interview by asking, "Would you first tell us something about yourself?" All 9 respondents briefly introduced themselves. A typical response. "I'm Martin. I am married, same wife for 41 years. I have 3 children. One is a physician, one is an attorney, and one is an executive. We have 7 grandchildren. I recently sold my business. I am now active in several religious organizations and 2 that help young people get started in business." All the respondents currently owned and managed their own businesses or had recently retired after selling a business. All except Mr. Andrews, who was 62, were in their mid-60s to late 70s. After the respondents briefly introduced themselves, they discussed their financial goals. The first to respond was Mr. Andrews. He said, "Being in business for myself, when I wake up, every day is a challenge. I plan my work, work my plan. It's why my business is a good one." Mr. Andrews discussed his current gift-giving and how his wealth would be distributed in the future. He said, "I have a son-in-law who is a physician, another is an attorney. They are well-off, high-income generators. They are both in the highest tax brackets. They don't need my money. But their wives, my girls, my daughters do. They are spenders. Of course, I have always spoiled them rotten, and I'm paying for it now. They call and ask me to pay for their kids' pianos, and I buy pianos. Bicycles and birthday parties, I pay for them too. I enjoy giving them money." My daughters are the beneficiaries of all my life insurance policies, more than enough to take care of all my estate's taxes and expenses. The girls are left with the balance. After I'm gone, it makes no difference to me how they dispose of my money. They can keep it, shoot craps with it, but I just want them to be happy. Happy, to Mr. Andrews, means having money to spend. And pride is having daughters who are married to high-income generators. He spoke repeatedly about these issues. Seated next to Mr. Andrews was Mr. Russell, a very wealthy retired gentleman who had recently sold his manufacturing business. Immediately following Mr. Andrews' admission that he spoiled his daughters, Mr. Russell moved forward in his chair and made the following statement. I have three daughters. All have careers, all are working. All are happy. All live a long way from here. They have their own lives to live. I'm not worried about paying for their futures. Nor are they. We don't discuss it. There will be a large sum, plenty, I'm sure, left over after I pass away. Another respondent, Mr. Joseph, nodded his head and stated, We have two daughters. One is a vice president for a large corporation, and the other is a scientist. We are very proud of them. They will be very well provided for. But as a family, we don't spend much time thinking about my estate. Mr. Russell and Mr. Joseph have the correct formula. If you are wealthy and want your children to become happy and independent adults, minimize discussions and behavior that center on the topic of receiving other people's money. Following these statements, one of the other respondents asked Mr. Andrews about the disposition of his business. His comments generated a series of interesting remarks from the more senior members of the group. Mr. Andrews stated, All the money I've been making in my business I dedicate to my daughters and their children. I don't need the money. The kids can use it. I give the maximum within the bounds of the law. What does Mr. Andrews plan to do about ownership of his business? Will he eventually sell it? Will he give it to the children to operate? Or does he have some other idea in mind? He said, I have an agreement with my oldest son. He is required to pay X amount of dollars each year, and Billy will eventually own the business outright. Several of the more senior respondents questioned this plan, since it clearly has the potential to create conflicts among Mr. Andrews' children. Mr. Andrews' business is in the service distribution industry. It does not have a great deal of value unless it continues to operate under the Andrews affiliation. In other words, unless Billy Andrews keeps the business operating, there will be no business at all. Asked one respondent, Would the business have significant value if you placed it for sale today? Mr. Andrews admitted that it would not. Then why is he requiring his oldest son and key employee to purchase the business? Why not give it to him? Remember, Mr. Andrews gives all of the profits of the business to his daughters. He also plans to give them the revenue he receives from the sale of the business, the money his son Billy pays for the business. Moreover, Mr. Andrews' daughters already receive sizable cash gifts from their father, but not Billy. Billy, in his father's estimation, needs no subsidies. He is extremely productive in generating income. He could always carry a great deal on his shoulders. Mr. Andrews feels that his daughters, on the other hand, do not have the ability to maintain an upper-middle-class lifestyle by themselves. But what about his high-income-producing sons-in-law? In Mr. Andrews' mind, his sons-in-law will never generate an income high enough to support the girls' high-consumption habits. Also, he told us, you can never fully trust your sons-in-law. Divorce is always a possibility. What about future outpatient care for his daughters? Billy, Mr. Andrews' surrogate, will provide the solution to this problem. Mr. Andrews' plan calls for Billy to make the payments to his sisters for years after Mr. Andrews' death. The money for these annual payments will come from the profits of his business. Is this unusual? No. Business owners, entrepreneurs, and physicians often find themselves in similar situations. In essence, Billy will be required to heavily subsidize his sister's lifestyle, a lifestyle predicated on conspicuous consumption. Mr. Andrews feels fairly certain that Billy will carry out his father's wishes. Perhaps he will. But how would you respond to this plan if you were Billy's wife? Think for a moment. Your husband is paying for his sister's expensive clothing, luxury automobiles, vacations, and so on. most spouses feel that charity begins at home. Note that spouses are often the initiators of family conflicts regarding inequities in the distribution of wealth. The other participants did not criticize Mr. Andrews' plan directly. When each spoke, he looked at the group in general, not at Mr. Andrews. Yet it became increasingly clear as the discussion progressed that the other respondents rated the Andrews plan a poor one. One senior respondent reflected on a related situation. He said, "A son grew impatient with his father. The son wanted to take over his father's business, but he did not wish to wait for dad to pass away. So the son opened his own business and actually competed with his father's." Mr. Andrews quickly countered, "My son signed a non-compete contract with me. Everything in a family is based on trust, isn't it?" The participants seemed to think about this statement for a moment. Perhaps Mr. Andrews was having some second thoughts about his plan. Shortly after Mr. Andrews made this comment, he revealed that his children were the executors of his estate. Mr. Harvey then raised his hand and asked if he could respond. We were delighted. Mr. Harvey was the oldest and wealthiest respondent in the group. He began by noting the importance of facilitating harmony among one's heirs. And according to him, the choice of executors of an estate was critical in this regard. Mr. Harvey had served as executor or co-executor of several estates. He understood full well that being an executor was a difficult task, and that there was often animosity among executors and the heirs of estates. For this reason, he had carefully chosen the executors of his estate. He said, "I have two children. They are close to each other. They can settle my estate between them, but they will do it along with my attorney. The children and my attorney are executors of my estate. I put the attorney in just to keep the balance. You know, when money's involved, what can happen. I want to keep good relations. But good relationships may deteriorate at the last moment without an experienced professional." Mr. Andrews then spoke. He asked, with a hint of a challenge, "Are you really going to use someone from outside the family as an executor?" In response, 7 of the 9 participants stated that in addition to a family member, at least one outsider would be co-executor of their estates. Mr. Ring, a retired entrepreneur and grandfather of 9 grandchildren, was one such participant. Mr. Ring had served as co-executor of several estates. He knew of situations in which the heirs to a grandparent's fortune were seriously spoiled children in their late 20s and 30s who did not have the training, discipline, or ambition to support the affluent lifestyle they had been conditioned to enjoy. Several of these adults still lived at home. All had been receiving outpatient care from their grandparents. But, as Mr. Ring explained, once the well ran dry, problems arose. When the grandparents died, the grandchildren and parents became adversaries. Each generation felt it should receive the bulk of the estate's proceeds. These experiences had a profound influence on Mr. Ring. He realized that long before one passes away, one should select professionals to be co-executors. Consequently, over the years, he had developed close relationships with a highly skilled estate attorney and an outstanding tax accountant. Mr. Ring sought their advice before he retired, realizing that someday these professionals would likely act on his behalf to prevent or at least reduce the probability that his grandchildren would battle over his estate. Through the years, he had also sought their counsel on how to give without spoiling. Mr. Ring now gives gifts to his grandchildren, but not in the form of products or social privileges. And he never gives without first gaining the approval and blessings of his grandchildren's parents. He said, "The trusts for the grandchildren are controlled. Money is distributed only when each grandchild reaches certain maturity. I was a little against it, but I listened to my lawyer and tax man. I don't want to reach out from the grave to control them. But the way the trusts are set up, my grandchildren will have to work." Mr. Ring's heirs will not begin to receive their inheritances until they approach their 30s. While some affluent grandparents give their grandchildren products and privileges, the Rings give them educations. Such gifts are intended to enhance their grandchildren's discipline, ambition, and independence. Mr. Graham spoke next. He reflected on his own experiences as a co-executor, which had helped him select co-executors for his own estate. He said, "You have to use your judgment. You have to have understanding and compassion. I was an executor of a close friend's estate of a substantial amount of money. I had discretionary power. Every decision was not necessarily dictated. When the daughter, age 23, was ready to marry, I knew her father would have wanted her to have a nice wedding. So we gave her the kind of wedding he would have given her. After she married and started a family, I was still not quite sure of her maturity. So I distributed only enough money for her to buy a nice home. Later, I was convinced that she was able to take care of herself, so I approved the distribution of what was left in the trust. The daughter received the balance of her inheritance just before her 30th birthday, when Mr. Graham judged her to be capable of handling her inheritance. She had demonstrated her maturity in her stable marriage, role as a mother, and career of her own. When selecting the executors of his own estate, Mr. Graham chose an attorney who was an old friend. He discovered that it's better for the children to be mad at the arbitrator than with each other. Mr. Ward, yet another affluent respondent, had also served as a co-executor. He chose two attorneys as executors of his multi-million-dollar estate rather than his sons or daughters. One of the attorneys was his niece, the other a partner in one of the top law firms in the country. Mr. Ward explained his choices. I chose younger attorneys because I felt that they would have a better understanding of the needs of the heirs of my estate. Both have the greatest integrity and understanding, and the two of them know each other professionally. Beyond understanding, empathy, and integrity, another characteristic was critical to Mr. Ward. He said, "The attorney who wrote my will was the one I selected as co-executor along with my niece. I felt that if there was a dispute between my sons and sons-in-law, that he would be a good one to arbitrate. That's the reason I selected him. He's been a personal friend for a long time and a very successful businessman." Mr. Ward's comments are congruent with many of our research findings. First, most PAWs have long-term close relationships with several key professionals, such as top attorneys and accountants. Second, many people in Mr. Ward's category have relatives and/or close friends who advise them about wills, trusts, estates, and gift-giving. In fact, all things being equal, estates in which the heirs, typically the sons and daughters, are professional estate attorneys tend to be taxed less. Sons and daughters who are attorneys act as formal and informal legal advisors and opinion leaders for their affluent parents. They have a significant influence over all aspects of estate plans, including the choice of the estate attorney, provisions in wills, the ultimate disposition of family assets, the choice of executors, the use of trust services, and the incidence and size of the financial gifts to be given to children and grandchildren. Attorney relatives typically advise their affluent parents on how to minimize estate taxes via annual gift-giving to the children and grandchildren. Thus, the mere presence of a son or daughter who is an attorney increases the probability that all the children in the family will receive substantial cash gifts from their parents. Consequently, these children inherit smaller amounts than the norm for all children of the affluent, since much of the wealth in their parents' estates is distributed to the attorney and siblings prior to the death of their parents. What were all of these experienced respondents trying to tell Mr. Andrews? First, that his estate was complex, with many subjective provisions. He had acknowledged that his plan contained numerous verbal promises and monetary commitments. Mr. Andrews needed expert advice on how to handle these complex arrangements. He would be wise to consider having an estate attorney or arbitrator as the co-executor of his estate. Otherwise, his estate plan could very well become the cause of much conflict and animosity among his children. But what if Mr. Andrews is like many other under-accumulators of wealth we have interviewed? In that case, he is not likely to establish close and long-term working relationships with professionals such as attorneys. Remember that Mr. Andrews stated that he needed no outsiders to help him because, "I trust my children, it is all based on trust." But trust is not the only element in such situations. Rules for affluent parents and productive children. The affluent who have successful adult children have given us much valuable information on how they raised them. Here are some of their guidelines. 1. Never tell children that their parents are wealthy. Why is it that many of the adult children of UAWs are more likely to earn high incomes than to accumulate wealth? We believe one of the major reasons is that as children they were constantly told their parents were wealthy. Adult UAWs tend to be the product of parents who lived in ways they thought appropriate for wealthy people to